So, in the Heart Sutra, or the heart of the teachings on the perfection of wisdom, after the opening, where the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, which is the Sanskrit name of the being that would also be called Kuan Yin, the embodiment of compassion, the path of deep listening. The Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara meditates on the skanda, or khanda in Pali, the aspects or aggregates of experience, form, feeling, or affect, perceptions, formations, consciousness, sees that they're empty, and then announces that emptiness in this core formulation to Shariputra, the eldest in wisdom, or the most foremost in wisdom, of the Buddha's original monastics. So the Bodhisattva has this insight in meditation, announces it to the disciple, and says it this way: form is empty, right? Or form has the nature of emptiness. Emptiness also has the nature of form. So form and emptiness are coexistent, co-arising, not separate. All form is marked by emptiness, or has the characteristic of emptiness. Again, emptiness means empty of swabhava, empty of inherent permanent self-existence or essential nature. So, form, and form particularly means forms as seen by the eye, but it also means bodies, physical objects. They are empty of a kind of permanent identity, right? The teacup is only temporarily a teacup. It was mud, and eventually it will become shards. Maybe it will become, decorative fragments in a mosaic. And, at the moment, it's also my favorite cup. And at some point, it will become the broken cup that was once my favorite. And maybe, I will have a memory of the cup when once it becomes a part of a mosaic or a children's art piece. And then someday, maybe far, far in the future, once again, mud, right? And so it doesn't possess the inherent nature of being a teacup, right? It's just temporarily a teacup. And of course, that's true for everything. So our body is composed of the four great elements, the Buddha would say, sharing those elements with everything around us, everything composed of the solidity of earth, the liquidity of water, the temperature of fire, the movement quality of wind, and the extendedness of spatiality, everything participating in the same fluctuating process nature, means that nothing has inherent essence or svabhava. So everything is empty of essence. Form is empty of essence, Avalo says to Shariputra. And then it says it's the same for all of the rest of the aggregates. So feelings are like this, the realm of affect, pleasant, unpleasant. There's nothing fundamentally pleasant or unpleasant in a thing, right? You find a certain taste unpleasant, and then you take a medicine or get COVID or whatever, and you can't taste it, and it's no longer unpleasant, right? Where did the unpleasantness go? It was based in conditions. The thing itself is not inherently pleasant or unpleasant, right? You find a certain thing unpleasant, and then you fall in love with somebody and perceive that same thing from the state of being in love with somebody, and suddenly it's pleasant. How did that happen? The pleasantness or unpleasantness was not contained in the rose or the sunset or the orgasm, for that matter, right? It was conditioned, and it's based in context, right? Everything is conditioned and based in context. So form, feeling, perceptions, formations, sense consciousness itself, empty of permanent solid essence. So having exclaimed this to Shariputra, Avalokiteshvara goes on, therefore, Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. Dharmas here means things or experiences. Everything is marked by emptiness. And then the text goes through several of the basic categories of the Buddha's teaching, beginning with the senses. And here's one of the most, you know, great sort of poetic drumbeats of the text. Therefore, in emptiness, there is no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no seeing, no hearing, no smelling, no tasting, no touching, no thinking. Right? That all of these things that we think of as solid or predictable or understandable experiences, but particularly these sensory experiences through which we define our sense of self, they're empty. We can think about, you know, think about seeing and how we could have the idea that to see something for ourselves means knowing that it's true. And the texts themselves use this metaphor all the time, right? One of the qualities of the Dhamma in the early tradition is that it is ehipasiko, to be seen for oneself, right? The word vipassana means to see it clearly. See it clearly. We use see as a synonym of knowing, right? Ah, I see actually means, oh, I understand. So to see something is to understand. Seeing is believing. Oh, you disciples, you don't believe it's me. Stick your finger through the wound in my hand, you know. Doubting Thomas. You have to see it for yourself. But now we're in the era, right, of deep fakes and optical illusions. There's more and more, and it's only going to accelerate. What you see in the digital world, particularly, is unreliable as to its reality, you know? Even today, I posted a photograph that I took last week in a redwood forest on the Facebook post for this very gathering tonight. And I don't always do this, but the light was a tiny bit dim in the photo that I took. So I just, you know, without even thinking otherwise, you know, I just popped it open in photos, you know, brightened the color just a tiny bit, gave it a little bit more light. And I was like, oh, that's nice. You know, pop the green moss on the redwood tree a little bit and then posted it. So that's not actually what it looked like, right? Or actually, it's never exactly what it looked like because a photograph is never like what it actually looked like. But that's also not exactly what the camera took. So it's several layers removed from reality. And now you can, they're very close to, you know, being able to, post a video of, you know, someone who's been long dead, speaking to you, right? I have no doubt that in elections soon, you'll have, you know, endorsements, right, from, Jack Kennedy speaking from beyond the grave saying, hi, this is Jack Kennedy. This is a bad impression, right? If I was still alive, I would totally vote for Kamala Harris, and I think you should too. You know, we will see this, right? Hello, this is Abraham Lincoln, and I know I'm dead, but you know, and so like more and more seeing is being challenged by the intense deceptive quality of the media around us. But But in emptiness, the understanding actually is that when the mind gets really quiet, what we can notice is that even what we think of as our direct perception is already filtered by concepts, right? So part of this is in the natural, you know, neurological function of perception. Like, part of the way that we know where we are and who we are and what to do in the world is that the senses, the mind, using the information from the senses, does a kind of mapping of the world around us. You know, you can walk through your house in the dark and you kind of know where things are, right? Without directly seeing them. The mind has seen and categorized and sort of fixated all of these things so that I know what I'm looking at pretty much all the time. And the mind doesn't like not recognizing things. You know that feeling when you see somebody, you kind of recognize them, but you can't place them? And it really nags the mind, you know? Or you see a moment that I really like is a moment when like maybe the light is a little bit dim or something is off to the side of perception, and I see something and my mind at first thinks it's something like, oh, I think it's a, my mind says person standing there, you know, and then I look over and there's a rake against the side of a shed and there's a shadow and a hanging, you know, bag. And my mind didn't see that stuff directly. And so it said person. And I looked and it was a rake in a bag. And for a long time, I decided that those moments were when you're seeing ghosts and that's what ghosts do, is they're only perceivable kind of at the edge of perception. But when you actually look, it's just a rake in a bag. And so I got into the habit of saying hello to them whenever that happened. I'd say, oh, hello, you know, just in case. I was actually seeing what was really there. And then when I looked, you know, it disappears. But I actually really came to like that moment of confused perception where I don't actually know what the thing is, because it reminds me that there's a veil of conceptualization and recognition that's always between myself and, you know, the seen world or the heard world or the sensed world. And what the teaching on emptiness reminds us of, the reminder is that the concepts that we hold about what things are, which includes what we are in relation to them, that those concepts are temporary, fragile, unreliable, not permanent. They don't actually define the thing. And that this goes all the way, this sort of goes all the way into the real substrate of the operating system. Of the cognitive operating system. But the only way to really touch this, I think, you can't really do this conceptually. You can't walk around being like, nothing is real. Like, you can try. It doesn't actually penetrate that much. Like, that it's, you know, you can get stoned with a bunch of your like friends from college and be like, dudes, nothing is real. And it's like, you know, you can get a little bit of insight in that state. But the mind actually is still too busy to really perceive it. The thing that the emptiness teachings ask us to do is to actually do what Avalokiteshvara was doing, which is to be deep in meditation. Because the pathway to perceiving emptiness is not just a cognitive, like, trick where you can be like, okay, don't perceive anything as what it is. It's too baked in. You can't see through recognition on purpose. What you can do, however, is you can practice a meditation, a samadhi, essentially, that is deeply thought-free, You practice emptying the mind of the surface level cognitions of story, narrative, judgment, complaining, analysis. And then from there, and that's just the first level, but from there, there's a kind of, I would say, deeply somatic enlivening that happens. And what it's like for me is I have to, I get as quiet as I can, mostly in meditation, but you can do this in some kinds of other flow states in movement. You can do it sometimes dancing. Get really quiet on the cognitive level. Set the stories down. And then it feels to me something like let the life of the body, this is really a kind of eros, I think. Let the vibrance of sensed experience, so all the physical senses, all the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, feeling energies, let them be or open to them being as full as possible. But, or and, anytime the veil of idea or like fixating in a certain way comes into play, you know, so this could be an idea about something. It could also be like, you know, the affect layer. I like this, right? They're like, ooh, I like it, or oh, I don't like it. That's a conceptual layer also. It's natural. It's a natural instinctive feeling, but the intent is to not let that proliferate into story. So you can just let that be there. Like, okay, you know, there's liking, whatever. But the meditation is just to let the feeling, the sensations be as luminous as you can possibly feel, right? As luminous as they naturally are, I think, without conceptual overlay. And that's just a discipline. This is something you can practice, just like move around through the world and do this. It helps to not have to have conversations. But at some point, if you're like biking across town, don't do it driving, but you know, you're like walking across town or you're out in the woods or you're moving through your house, making a cup of tea or something. Practice being a fully sensate, non-cognitive creature. And if you want to play with it, you can play with experiencing the world around you as if you don't know what it is. Almost like, and it's, you know, it's fine to know what it is. Like you turn through a doorway, you don't just walk into the wall. But there can be a kind of being willing to experience everything as new, right? Or at least unbound by habitual use. And to finish up, just in this brief hint toward this, I want to suggest that this can both be super mystical and psychedelic. Like you can really go into like, whoa, with this. But you can also be in this kind of practice in a very, very ordinary kind of way. And this is really what much Zen training points to, is that like this is the fundamental practice, but it's very ordinary, right? You just hold the cup and it's a cup and it's cold and smooth and inside it is this wonderful stuff that's cold and smooth and liquidy and you know, and if I don't even call it water and I just sort of let the whole experience of the thing unfold naturally with a kind of divine presence, this is very much at the heart of, you know, a Zen style of practice where it's like nothing special. But it's not nothing special just as an idea that you lay over things. It's really a meditation where you don't let the idea of special or anything interfere with the immediacy of living experience. And so the text says, no eye, no ear, no nose, like there's no such thing as an eye. Right, because as soon as I lay in the concept of seeing, oh, I'm seeing you, that gets in the way. That's not the thing, right? All of the concepts around the senses are not the thing. Even our idea of what's happening in seeing, right, that photons are bouncing off the reflective surface of the thing and hitting my retina, like, sure, but that's totally an idea. And the direct, whatever that means, experience of seeing, if I can quiet the veil enough, get the like the moving, shimmering aspect of the cognitive field still enough, this is a very classic metaphor, it becomes mirror-like. It becomes, in a way, like transparent or translucent or mirror-like. And it just shows things as they are. And there's a directness to it. And so in relation to the senses, I think in a beautiful paradox, what this ends up being is that emptiness practice with the senses means being profoundly embodied. Because I've really set aside even the concepts of body and sense and all the things that I think about the body. It's not embodiment if I'm thinking about the body. There's a kind of, you know, visceral, muscular, sensate, you know, aliveness to embodiment that really, as we cultivate it, can become a very deep home in this world. It's a reliable refuge. Whether the body is comfortable or uncomfortable, it can become a deeply nourishing, abiding. So I think this is part of what the text is pointing to and just reminding us of in this passage. All right, so we'll let it go there for now. Thank you so much. Blessings.